Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Kevin Boileau at Epis Radio. I'm in the studio with Nazarita Goldhammer. The title of our show today is a question. It is there a way out of violence, capitalism, and nihilism? As you know, we've been engaged in a long block of shows about violence and its relationship to capitalism and nihilism. So it makes sense to us that we would start a block of shows about a praxis as a way out. And we do that because we have a fundamental assumption that most people don't like violence, especially when it comes knocking on your front door. Nihilism really wreaks havoc on people's health and well-being, and I've explained that over and over. Capitalism is an addictive, compulsive economic system. So, sure, there are some people who love capitalism because it feeds their addiction. There's some people who love violence because it's how they interpret Eros. There's some people who love nihilism because they instrumentalize everybody. They don't understand any notion of intrinsic values or anything like that. So our fundamental assumption is that it's worthwhile to even entertain this question. But like I said, I think there's some people who would think this radio show today is just nonsense. They would argue that we want to be in the state that we're in, which is just a really different worldview for me, I can tell you personally. There's a lot of evidence. There's some good thinking by a lot of diligent people that suggests this isn't going to end well. If you continue a system like capitalism that has an incessant need to get bigger, better, faster, but you have a limited resource space, and violence is accepted towards a lot of different beings, towards many beings, and we live in a nihilistic state in which everything is open for change. Values are not sacrosanct anymore. When we're so much in this black hole that just keeps getting bigger and bigger, it's really difficult to conceptualize how to change course. You can always change course early on, right? If you see a problem coming. That's why there's a value in prediction. You know, there are predictive models about a lot of things. I've been trained for decades about predictive models to, you know, they're not perfect, but they help us consider, you know, where things are headed. And I think that helps us survive. So we thought we would do a series of shows on a praxis or a method that we could develop to think about moving out of or transforming away from a culture of violence, capitalism, and nihilism. So here we go. Nazarita's on the show. I'm going to be tuning in with her in just a little bit, asking some questions. What I like to do, too, is when I think of praxis towards anything. So, for example, let's take a simple problem. Let's say that I want to change my overall fitness level as a person, my health and wellness and my fitness, whatever it is. I want to sleep better. I want to eat better. I want to be at my optimum weight. I want to do all these things that make me a better me or more of who I am. More energy to do the things I want to do. Better thinking abilities so I can do my work. So I need a praxis. Without a praxis, I'm just fumbling in the dark, and I'm not going to get anywhere at all. It's never going to happen. So I need a method, I need organization, I need strategy, and I need tactics. If I'm going to write a book, same deal. If I'm going to do well at a job, same deal. If I'm going to have a successful relationship with a friend, same deal. So praxis is about dealing with these transformative questions at a values level. I think that's part of it. Also at a critical thinking level, where we think against ourselves, where we challenge our critical thinking toolkit, our thinking toolkit, what the tools are in the toolkit itself, how I understand the toolkit, where I can get my tools from, all these things, all these little items go into this way out, this method. So just quickly, I'm looking at the book we published called Deventonomy, A Transhumanist Phenomenology of the Self. It's got some nice sections on solidarity and responsibility in it, and then another section on some basic principles on concrete transformation of the self. So if we think that there's an end goal, which can be helpful, an end goal is a state that produces a teleology, logos of the telos, right, where we want to go. Let's say that telos is nonviolence, nonviolent self, nonviolent culture. That could include elements like responsibility, solidarity, more empathy, better thinking. So these things help me formulate the way I talk about answering this question. And we're going to get into a lot more detail. I'm gonna ask the question though to Nazarita. We're going to start generally today and next time, and we'll gradually make our discussion more sophisticated, and we'll see how far we can get in it. But let's just start with the simple question about a way out. And the reason I present it like this is because when I used to practice psychotherapy full time, where I'd have 40 sessions every week, I would see all these people who, many of them didn't feel like they had a way out of their present condition, their present predicament, their present situation, whatever it was, drug addiction, depression, anxiety, violence, horrible marriage, bad job, poor health, a dissatisfying job trajectory. There's all sorts of reasons that people feel like they don't have a way out. So when we ask this question, we were asking it at the cultural level, but we're also asking it at the individual level. Nothing is truly going to change in a culture or a country if we rely on somebody else to do it or to get the job done, or if we rely on our Congress people to get the job done. That's not how it works. So we need to be much more perspicacious. We need to be much smarter and think about things that appear beautiful and pretty and nice in our culture, because a lot of them are held in place by violence and the compulsions of capitalism and the madness of nihilism. So we don't want to just be flat-footed thinkers. That's what we call the received view. That's the infantile level of consciousness. We want to delve into that. Nazarita, welcome to the show. I'm glad you're here. How do we begin to think our way through to answer this question, is there a way out of violence, capitalism, and nihilism? Now, I know we're just going to introduce our listeners to this today, but we got to start somewhere. So what do you think? How can we start to approach this question?
Well, something that I've been thinking about on the approach to actually a way out of violence and capitalism and nihilism is the way that we construct our feeling about it. I think most people in this time anyway, especially in the age of technology and everything being done fast and easy, we want an easy way out. We want someone to say, just do this. Just quit using straws and everything will be okay. Don't worry about anything else. Just bring your own bag to the store and then everything will take care of itself. And I think that we constantly seek an easy way or a quick way that gets us from point A to B. And the point being, you know, capitalism, violence, to a more peaceful world, something that is more sustaining, enveloping of our senses in connection with our emotions and our senses, with other animals, with the earth. That's like there's point A where we are and then point B. And in between those, point A and B, is this huge chasm. And I once had this amazing vision that stayed with me a very long time that keeps coming back to me when we have these discussions. And it is exactly that we're standing on this beautiful mountain and there's a precipice. And on the, if we just gaze straight ahead, there's another mountain that's even more beautiful that is real. And in between there is a chasm. At the bottom of that chasm are this amazing reward, the jewels of the what would you call it, the work of getting to the other place. There's no easy way of leaping across and then everything is perfect. And so I believe we have to rearrange to really look at the way we construct how we want to get out. And that's the work. The work is, how do I view this? Am I always looking for something that will be easy? And then if it's too hard, I don't want to do it. Is it too hard to give up capitalism, to really start to unwind it, to start to say, what would it be like if I didn't go shopping? And what would it be like if I didn't purchase this? What would it be like, you spoke about health, if I didn't eat right, what would it be like? And why am I wanting something easy? Because those are the questions that lead us to how do we actually construct a way out. We have to look at what goes into the effort. When people are getting ready to mountain climb, they don't just say, hey, you know, I have it all in my mind, I'm going to just climb up that mountain, I'm not going to take anything, even though, you know, I should, I'm not going to, it's going to be easy. And then a lot of people die on those kind of treks. So it's the preparation of really what we're talking about. We're talking about, if we want to get out and we really want to see a way out, we can't wallow where we are. We have to look and see our expectations of what it means to actually get out of capitalism. And the last thing is, I'm reminded always of the movie The Matrix. It's kind of amazing that it was so long ago and yet so relevant to our time. Is when he got out of the matrix, which was the normal everyday life that all humans are hooked in these eggs, using their brain energy and all their life energy in technology to funnel this world that is a construct of fakeness, of unreality, but everybody is living in there, thinking in their mind that it's real. And when he gets out of the matrix and he sees this and he sees the world as this harsh, horrible place, because that's what humans have done to it, and that everybody is living in this fantasy of going to work every day, eating steak, doing all these things, it's really relevant to our world, is that if we don't find a way out, there's always that what if, then we end up living in that matrix, which is this fake satisfaction of going to work every day, dressing up, doing these fake relationships, doing these fake emotions, buying these fake things, polluting the world, thinking that we're doing something good and we're satisfying our desires and everything that we think is pleasurable. But in reality, it is fake. It's not real. That's what I've been thinking in terms of this, is what is my attitude toward change? Like, I want it to be easy, but then I have to look at that and say, why do I want it to be easy? Because effort takes really looking at how you're entwined in this matrix of violence, capitalism, nihilism. What is my part? And then how do I begin to disentangle? Because people know when you're real. They know when you say something, if you really know what you're talking about, they know it. And they will gather around if you're saying something that you really know.
That's interesting. The idea of fake. The idea of fake. We have an internet full of fakery, an illusion, sometimes called, well, it's a product of what Baudrillard calls hyper-reality, that this constructed reality that we've made, mostly with images, is not reality. It's a poisoned simulacrum of reality. But I'm thinking about what you're saying, and I'm thinking about the symposium, the Platonic dialogue, which was penned somewhere around 370 BC, and these guys are all at a banquet, so they're eating, they're drinking, and they're all talking about Eros. They're all praising Eros, and which as constructed is the god of love and desire. So Eros starts as concretely, in a vulgar sense, a watered down physical desire. It can be for sex, it can be for all of the things that people become addicted to, right? Eros propels us to have desires for lots of different things. Could be drugs, could be booze, it could be plastic surgery, whatever. And so in the symposium, all these different men, I think there are seven men, are giving these praises of Eros. And Socrates happens to be in the room. And when Socrates is in the room, that you're going to get the best dialectician who's ever walked the planet, better than Nietzsche, better than anybody, because this guy knows how to talk. He's a challenger. Plato presents him in such a beautiful way. And so Socrates, when he starts talking, he relates a story about Diotima. And Diotima starts, is talking about Eros. And that Eros is not a god, but that it's a spirit that mediates between humans and our objects of desire. Because there's always a distance. It's an ontological gap between humans and their objects of desire. So, to make a long story super short, there's this idea of beauty that we have in concrete things that turn out to be pretty vulgar. I mean, there's nothing wrong with bodily pleasure or anything like that. But what Socrates teaches us through the figure of Diotima is that we can learn reason through the developing interpretation of Eros, that enables us to seek the good. I mean, that's sort of the conclusion here. So that we have love for beautiful things can and does, if we're open to it, propel us to having love for beautiful ideas. And so, in a critique of violence, where we define violence as that which destroys, that doesn't seem to be beautiful at all, because what you've done is you've stultified the generation of new meaning. All violence does is destroy. You have to do something else to create new meaning, and that's to think. And in the symposium, when Socrates speaks, then he uses the figure of Diotima to help humans understand that in desire and in our quest for the beautiful, we can actually find the good. Now, why is this important to our question? This is important to our question because it gives us a starting point. Wouldn't we want to know, we humans, if we want to survive and we want to flourish, wouldn't we want to know what the good is, or what good things are, or what a good telos is, or how we should aim our life? Of course. And so Socrates, in his brilliance, uses something that we all have, which is desire. We all wrestle with desire. So we did some radio shows about 6 or 7 years ago, Nazarene and I, on authenticity and Eros. And if I recall, it's been a long time, but if I recall, we had some discussion about how Eros can be interpreted in a number of ways. And to go back, Nazarene, to something you just said, Eros is largely being interpreted now in terms of very totalized totalitarian structures, the illusions of the internet, definitely using the specular, focusing on what we see in false images. Eros is being interpreted in terms of violence. It comes out as sadism. You know, if you look at crushing videos or porn that disrespects people who are in those videos. Capitalism, which is totally built on desire to have more. The urge to accumulate is totally an addiction. It's based on desire of a false image and a false sense of the good. And what nihilism does, nihilism is the trickster. If you know anything about the trickster in history books that you read, the trickster here is nihilism, because nihilism says there's no intrinsic value of any kind. There's nothing. And it makes us believe that that's true. It's the dark energy in the human soul. And it cons us into believing that all values are only instrumental, and they're only to be used as such. And if you're a clever speaker, or you've read a lot of books, or you're a fast talker, or you learned how to debate, then you can use your power to prove to somebody why instrumentalized value that you're aiming for is better than their own argument. Those sorts of aggressive conversations go nowhere. They're a complete waste of time. Aggressive debate, it's lunacy, and it's absolutely unintelligent. And that's a function of nihilism. So instead of us seeking the good with a capital G, which would include intrinsic values, like I think one intrinsic value is empathy. having a great awareness of the suffering of another sentient being. That, to me, is an intrinsic value by virtue of being a human being, by virtue of being a sentient being. And I can prove it. And maybe we could make a list of values that together make up a constellation we understand as the good of capital G. So you can see why diatoma is so powerful here. We have this opportunity to start to allow something that we have, desire, and we all have it because that's a structure of consciousness, to move as protension towards a future, a nomadic focus on object, etc. Something that we don't have or something we think we need to have in some way. But we can utilize that as propulsion. I think propulsion and motivation. And in Socrates' schema here in the symposium, as Plato presents it, then we can gain higher and higher forms through critical thinking. And in that search for beauty, we find truth. And, you know, we have the poem, you know, that expresses the relationship between beauty and truth. So, what do you think, Nazarita, about this idea that we have been discussing, I think, for many years, at least 7 or 8 years, about Eros and how Eros in this culture has become so complicated and worn out, convoluted, repressed, suppressed, guilty, full of resentment, and ends up in violence, being supported by capitalism, the urge to have, and then being completely tricked by all structure in our culture, nihilist structure. Like here's an example. I cannot avoid this example. Yeah, the average random American thinks that you should go get health care insurance and that you should take care of your health by going to see a doctor who is an MD, that health is a good thing, well-being is a good thing, and that the health system is there to help you. It's to help you be better. It's to help you be healthier and happier, to do good things so that you can do good things in the world. And if you start thinking about it, you eventually realize, as some people have, that our healthcare system touts these values but does not live these values, that the dominant form of healthcare in our country is a plan to keep people sick, to keep pumping drugs into them, to keep them going back to the doctor, and to use outmoded paradigms of so-called science for our health. What do you think about that, Nazarita?
I think that that is an awakening that people need to really look at. And we have a lot of documentaries on that. We have everything, and yet people still persist in that way of thinking. And the pharmaceutical industry is really violent. They don't really care that it's harmful to people, that pharmaceuticals kill more people every year than are killed in automobile accidents, suicide, and all the other things combined. It kills a lot of people every year, and yet people persist in thinking that pharmaceuticals are the ultimate way to go if anything is wrong. Consequently, we have, you know, super bugs that don't respond anymore, that I think we're setting ourselves up as a human race for one of those huge pandemics, which wipes out, you know, this huge population of humans and animals and everything else because of our hubris in thinking that this is the easy way to deal with health, instead of recognizing, you know, the body-mind connection. So desire, I think this is really interesting. You said something, violence is that which destroys. And I think of people who become more and more violent. And I think of them as They don't know a way out. They don't know. We're discussing that. What is a way out? They don't know a way out. So they turn that seeking, that desire, that need for a different kind of eros internally, and they live it through violence. It becomes their eros. And it becomes something that they're swayed into thinking is the true, the bright, the shiny. And it's not. I love the idea of the trickster. Trickster is in every single culture. Every ancient cultures have the trickster. The trickster serves such an important part of every culture, because what it does is it takes people who think that they're ready for the real, and it tests them to see if they are. Are you ready, or are you going to be swayed by every shiny object that comes your way, of which then you need more work? You need to look at it closer. There is an ancient, I think it's in the Eastern Hindu religion, which says, if you die with unfulfilled desires, you will reincarnate in the heart of those desires, because you have to fulfill them before, or conquer them before, you can get off the wheel of birth and rebirth in order to help others. That you have to face those desires. And I think that is very interesting. Here's a really real experience that I think everyone can relate to. When I was young, I was really addicted to Coca-Cola. I mean, I drank like at least 6 Coca-Colas a day. And I loved them, and they gave me energy, and I couldn't even imagine not drinking. I didn't drink anything else but that. I didn't drink water. Water tasted bad, but Coca-Cola tasted really good. The colder and icier, the better. And I knew that I had to stop drinking it, so I cut it down, and I finally gave it up. And it was it was really difficult. It wasn't easy. There's no pill to say, here, take this pill and you won't desire Coca-Cola anymore. It was hard. And everywhere I looked, I wanted Coca-Cola. And yet, after I had stopped drinking it for a long time, I had a sip of it and it was like poison. It was like, ew, this is what I was craving, is that this horrible chemical laden, overly sweet, fake drink. But it was only after that hard period of weaning myself away of the way out of Coca-Cola that I could actually see what it was doing to me and what
that's
the realness
right.
of. Isn't that interesting? Isn't
right.
that, I mean, that's really what we're talking about.
Right. Let me give you some examples. So, Dr. Dean Ornish, who I actually think is really smart and a really caring person, has been one of the proponents of a complete transformation in medical school education to teach preventative care and nutrition, which is not regularly taught in the curriculum. I used to work at a medical school. And in fact, you know, read this curriculum and I was mortified. What happened is that medicine, like a lot of other practices and ways of thinking, stemmed from the Cartesian Newtonian paradigm of the human anthropology. There's a historical philosophical concept called mechanism. And in fact, that's why doctors are called physicians. Physician. A person who uses these processes in the material world of physics to do something to the body, presumably to restore health. So education starting from, you know, the late 1800s in medical school focused solely on treating the human body as a natural artifact of the world. It was exactly the same model. And in fact, Freud took over that model in psychoanalysis. He was always a neurologist, one of the greatest. He thought that psychoanalysis would become a, neurology at some point, and wrote a really brilliant work on that. But we don't have the system now that actually prevents a lot of these problems that happen. So you go to the doctor and you have the help of a physician. So this isn't really necessarily, now, that's not to say that you know, everybody's the same or every doctor is the same. That's not at all what we're saying here. But there's an example of nihilism here, and that is the values that are expressed in the media are, you know, you've got to have health insurance, you've got to go see the doctor so you can be well. And the fact of the matter is iatrogenic illness, it continues to rise. In other words, going to the doctor will make you sick. Going to a hospital will make you sick for lots of reasons. And once you get in that system, then you are part of a bureaucratic, money-making scam system that doesn't necessarily restore your health. A related example, I talked to a psychiatrist years ago. He had finally given it up, and now does psychoanalysis. But I talked to him about psychiatry and psychopharmacology and about restoring health and this and that. And we had this conversation. He looked at me and he said, psychiatry is not about restoring health. It's not about making people happy. He said, it's about managing populations. You give people up on drugs, and then you manage the drug. I'm one of a population of practitioners and theorists who is utterly disgusted at the pill pushing that psychiatrists engage in, especially for so-called depression and anxiety. It's a way for governmental control over minds. No, that's not conspiratorial theory. It's the fucking truth. And, you know, I've been saying this for 25 years. But nihilism is a deep algorithmic structure in our culture in which we have a value that operates as a highest value that has no force and effect. Example is health, well-being, healthcare. So you go to see the doctor, you go to the hospital in this allopathic system, and you may not get what you think you're going there for. Like my own father, who's almost 90, said he hates going to the hospital because he knows in general it means that they've got their claws in him and that he will get sicker. And so he does everything he can to stay out of the hospital. It's an awful place to be. So, okay, where does that leave us? Simply put, I think that medical education in this country should be revolutionized. I know that a lot of, here's another example. There's a history of medical students harming animals. I know some of these former medical students are now teaching at medical schools. And there's a long history of harming animals for medical training. So there's another thing. Harm one sentient being to maybe dupe another person who happens to be a human being into the system. Or animal model so-called research. It's one of the greatest catastrophes of the Western culture, is to harm animals and to create a discourse around that, that it's somehow necessary and important. It's not. And it is a moral catastrophe. We don't have the right to do that, and yet we do, in the name of so-called science. And I have to tell, for anybody who's listening, science isn't just one thing. I happen to be a historian of science. And the idea of science changes through time. It has its virtues, it has its methods. And the methods of physical science, if you're a physicist, for example, were borrowed by the early medical doctors in the Western world. Double-blind studies, all sorts of studies that end up in psychopharmacology or pharmacology or animal model research. But there are other ways of doing science now. Phenomenology, for example, is becoming super important in German medical practice and in French medical practice, which are second to none in the world. So we need to all be a lot more critical. We need to have more critical thinking, right, as we mentioned in the beginning. So it's not a matter of, like, speaking ill of anybody or any particular person in a profession, but it means we have to think harder. We cannot be arrogant anymore. We can't do that. If we continue to be arrogant, we're going to continue to live in a culture of violence. Just talk to a friend of mine who knows somebody who's writing a book celebrating violence, that there's somehow a way to be healthy with violence. That is another function of nihilism. It's insane. It's absolutely insane. Nazarita, we've got 3 minutes left. Do you want to take us to close today?
I think you're on a roll. I'd love to hear something else that you have to say about that, actually.
Well, I feel very mouthy today, but the fact is we're in a pickle here where we're continuing to destroy the resources of the planet. We're continuing to harm each other. We're continuing to harm clean water, trees, other sentient beings. Our business schools are growing. Go get yourself a 2-year MBA. Go get rich. People are absolutely obsessed with making money in this culture, accumulating good looks through money, right? If you have a great Beverly Hills plastic surgeon, I don't care who you are, you can be pretty. You can be handsome. They're changing all anatomical proportions in your body now. So, and a lot of this has to do with capitalism, the science of proportion, and that you'll get a better job, and if your face is a certain ratio, you'll get a better job. So capitalism is driving personal identity, it's driving value systems, it's driving teleology, and all of this is being puppeted by the trickster. And in this culture, for me, the trickster is nihilism. And it's so basically we're harming ourselves to live. That's what it is. It's a logic flaw. We're killing ourselves to live. We're killing other things to live. We're read all the reports about clean water. Water shrinking. Clean water is shrinking. And it's eventually going to be at your doorstep wherever you are, no matter how wealthy you are. It's going to be at your doorstep too. So, this show is about thinking deep, using psychoanalysis, critical theory, phenomenology, mathematics, history, science, neuroscience, evolutionary theory, to try to figure out how we've gone so wrong. For a person to stand up right now and say things are going well on the planet, they would be a lunatic to say that, because it's not true. So again, these are deep value systems into why we think it's important to have this discussion. When we come back next time, we're gonna really hone in on some important ontological existential features of being in situation in your life. And there are moments in these situations when we can have intervention, and we have choices. We are radically free in that sense, but we need to learn how to recognize them. We need tools. We need to learn what to do in these situations to change the course of history. Otherwise, we just go right along and continue down this path of annihilation. Nazarita, thanks for being on the show. Thanks for being so gracious and allowing me to speak. Next time, we'll start with Nazarita Goldhammer. We're going to continue on. Thanks for everybody. Have a nice Christmas if you celebrate it. Happy holidays to everybody else. We'll see you next week.